Welcome to the Bad Apples, episode 11, season 2. This is where we throw the gauntlet down. And what gauntlet am I talking about? I'm talking about the gauntlet that we're fighting against a very big evil corporation. And which corporation is it? You can take a moment to guess. I'm not going to tell you yet. It's a big evil corporation. No, but first, I'm going to pause for a moment of silence. Linux Reality is dead. Yes, Chess Griffin, as you probably heard by now, because I waited too long to come out with this episode, so every other podcast probably concerning Linux has already covered this subject, but I wasn't going to be the only one not to have covered it, so there you go. Linux Reality, it's dead, it's over, and wow, what, I guess it's been 2 years, apparently. It didn't seem like 2 years to me, probably to Chess it did, but what a 2 years it's been. I can't tell you how influential and how, I think, profound that show was, because that show, even though the great thing about the show is that even though Chess is not going to be doing it anymore, you know, it's a podcast, it's still out there, it's going to be available. I emailed Chess and told him I would be happy to mirror all those episodes on my site, and in fact I think I probably will, because I've ever since I started listening to that show, I would download and archive every episode, because they were so great. I wanted to be able to listen to them again and again. So I've got pretty much all the episodes burned onto CDs. So I'll probably start uploading those to my site fairly soon, so that, you know, in case he ever stops the Libsyn account, then there's another place online for people to get it. And I mean, who wouldn't love those episodes? And I think, I just can't imagine anyone using Linux not listening to that show. It's such a great show, and so many people that have asked me about Linux, I've just been able to point them to that show, and they can listen to it and learn quite a bit. And they get pretty excited about it, because Chess just had this way of course, I'm talking about him like he's dead or something. He's still around. You see him on IRC all the time. But, you know, he had a way of presenting things on Linux Reality that were just very subtly excited, you know, about things. I mean, when I heard his discussion of Fedora, that's when I really decided to check out Fedora. And a couple of friends of mine have heard various shows of that podcast and have really started getting interested in Linux. So he had this way of really presenting it, and the methodical way he presented everything, and the study and the research that he clearly put into every episode is just really, really impressive. And to this day, it is unique. So many podcasters, myself included, are just kind of winging it. But Chess, it seemed like he just really, I mean, I swear he must have written the book before he even started the podcast, because everything was so linear and methodical and really clear and well put. So yeah, it's you know, I guess it's kind of a pity to see the podcast go, but it's not really that bad, because you really do feel, well, like Dave Yates said on his podcast, a lot of Linux links, it was kind of a mission accomplished, you know. I mean, he set out to, I guess, demystify and educate people about Linux, and that's what he did, and we'll always have, you know, that 100 episodes of just really, really great episodes. The fact that he's ending it is kind of a bummer, but at the same time, not so bad. So definitely, if you're not listening to Linux Reality, go check out all of his shows. But probably, if you know about me, you probably know for sure about Linux Reality. So, all right. So the Evil Empire. What was I talking about? You probably said Microsoft. Well, yeah, we're fighting that, but that's kind of a given, right? Besides, now that they've opened up all their software, they've gone open source, apparently, so they're not evil anymore. Oh, wait, apparently they haven't opened up all their software, but they're apparently doing something about working with Linux people, so I'm sure that's going to just change everything. No, the Evil Empire that I'm talking about is the sneaky one, Apple. I just can't understand lately why there are so many Macintosh computers around. Back, you know, in the 80s and 90s, I used to look around and I'd be the only one using a Mac, and I felt ashamed. And now it seems to be so hip and everyone's using a Mac. Even at Linux Expos, people are carrying around Macintosh computers, and I just can't understand it. And I try to assume that they're probably running Linux on that Mac, but sometimes you'll sneak a peek at their screen, and they're sure enough running the version of Unix that Mac markets themselves as running. So I'm not going to get too far into that, because I hope to get really deep into exactly what kind of Unix Mac really does run in some later episode. I want to talk more in this episode about marketing. Marketing with Macintosh obviously is just an art, and they have it really, really down, I guess, to a science, because they know how to tell people that they're running Unix. They know how to lull people into a sense of security. They know how to lull even open source programmers who are really into Linux over to Mac, because they say, oh, well, we're open source. We have this open source website for you to come to, and you can build a community up amongst yourselves to serve us, and so on and so forth. And it amazes me, because even if Mac is running Unix on underneath it all, everything else is closed source, proprietary, super locked down. It's getting worse with every new release of software that they make. They are getting more and more closed off, and it's just bizarre. And if you've ever tried to use a Mac as a Unix box, I think you're in for some really unpleasant surprises, but again, I'm going to get into that later. There's also been a Slashdot story that's been, I guess, making its rounds. A guy on the Slackware IRC channel turned me onto it. It reveals how Apple is basically keeping some of their APIs completely secret, so that third-party vendors, third-party developers, rather, cannot use those APIs, and these APIs obviously, or of course, are making Apple software seem faster, because they have access to this information and the third-party developers don't. The example in the article, if I recall correctly, was Safari versus Firefox or other browsers, and how Safari is able to load pages quicker due to some little APIs that Apple is deciding to use for themselves and not really letting anyone else in on. So even the developers that they're claiming to support and nurture, you know, they're keeping things from them, and they're only letting them develop to a point, which is just ridiculous. I don't understand why anyone using Linux would then turn to a Mac for anything. I just can't imagine doing that, simply because Mac is just so completely closed off. However, they are doing really well in their marketing. And the marketing should not sell anyone, but obviously it does. And the thing about marketing is that it's not real. It's fake. It's false information being sold as truth. How do I know this? Well, there's documentation out there from Apple itself. It's not internal documentation. It's freely available for everyone. There is a 15-page document on the 300 new features in the Leopard operating system, that is OS 10.5. These 300 new features I'm going to take one by one, or maybe two by two, over the next few episodes. Not this episode, because I actually have an interview and a discussion for this episode, but in the next couple of episodes, we're going to take a look at these 300 new features and compare it to its Linux competitor. And we'll see what the 300 new features are. We'll see how Apple is spinning things to seem like they're new innovations, new inventions, and reasons to buy their software. Whereas if you look at it a little bit further, a little bit deeper, and not too much deeper sometimes, you'll see that it really is just marketing hype. However, on this interview, I've got with me two really, really special guests who I was really happy that they, you know, I contacted them with this idea, and happily they were into it, and that was kind of cool. It's two podcasters. They did an episode on their podcast about the cost of running Windows, and I found that very interesting, because I have no idea what the cost of running Windows was, because I never ran Windows. And so I wanted to take it in a different direction and look at the cost of running Mac. And so I called them up, and we had a good long discussion about it, and let's give it a listen. I have with me Larry from the Going Linux podcast, and I also have Muad'Dib from also the Going Linux podcast. Muad'Dib, do you go by any other names?
AKA Tom. That's Tom. What I call myself when I'm here.
Yeah, that's a pretty bland name. So, Larry, who are you now? You got to have a sci-fi name to be on the show, and this is as official as it gets. So, come on, what's the name?
Oh, man, you put me on the spot again, and I'm not ready. I don't know.
You were supposed to think about that. All right, we're going to just call you...
Mort.
Mort.
That's it. Yeah, Mort. That's I'm sorry.
All right.
That's
your name. All right, I'll take that.
Mort and Muad'Dib from the Going Linux podcast. Guys, I listened to your episode 25, where you were analyzing the cost of Windows versus Linux. And I was actually really interested in it, because I have no experience with Windows.
And as I have no experience with, what is that other one?
I think...
Macintosh.
Yeah, Mac. And I do have a lot of experience with that.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of interesting that I think a lot of times the costs of these operating systems, to say nothing of the computers themselves, they kind of get absorbed, you know, because we don't really think about it. It's kind of a requirement. We pay the price. Or we just find it online, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And so you don't really think about the costs. And a lot of people these days, it seems, are kind of jumping the ship when it comes to Windows. But I think a lot of those people are kind of like looking at some of the marketing and stuff like that, and they're thinking about jumping maybe to the Mac platform.
Right.
Fair enough, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, as you guys pointed out in your episode, that's not a whole lot cheaper. The hardware itself is quite a lot more money, I think, than most like typical PCs.
Uh-huh.
As we said, though, it's good hardware.
It's very good hardware. And I mean, to be honest, most of the Linux machines that I'm running right now, simply because I am an old school Mac user, a lot of the machines that I'm running Linux on are Macintoshes. And, you know, I'm not having any problems with them. They're good machines. There's a lot of weird binary problems, driver, you know, firmware, things like that, for wireless cards and stuff like that that I have. But, you know, you're going to have that on any platform.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, the nice thing about working with the PC is that many of the PC makers do consider Linux when they put their computers together, IBM being one of them, and Dell being another. Yeah.
Sure.
So, and yeah. I'm sure that with the Macintosh, that's not something being compatible with Linux that Apple considers when it puts their computers together.
Well, that's why I think a lot of people, including, and it kind of concerns me, a lot of people are jumping over to Mac, I think, from Windows, but also even some Linux users you come across are kind of like considering Mac. And I think you mentioned it on your podcast, Larry. There were a considerable number of Macs, you know, at the show.
Yes,
and it kind of surprised me.
Yeah, at scale. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was kind of like, wow, what are these doing here? And they're like, well, you know, it runs Unix, and that's, I mean, it's true, but you know, I don't know how true, and we could talk about that some other time. But I think a lot of people going over to Mac are going to find that the hardware costs just up front, you know, and if you're not upgrading your Mac. The hardware costs are going to be kind of surprising to you. I mean, the cheapest Mac that they have out there is the Mac Mini, and that's kind of basically it's a laptop in a desktop, a very micro, you know, desktop shape. I think a lot of people have seen Mac Minis, and so you're not getting like really powerful hardware there. You're getting really kind of a low end laptop in a small form factor. You don't get a keyboard, you don't get a mouse, and you don't
get
a monitor.
Wait, you don't get a keyboard?
No, you don't get a keyboard with the Mac Mini.
It's just the basic processor. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Keyboard. I mean, if you get the Apple brand keyboard, and one of the things about Mac is that, you know, if you want to be a Mac user, you have to have the Mac equipment, right? You can't get a Mac Mini and then go out and get like a Microsoft keyboard or a Logitech keyboard. You know, you have to have the Mac branded keyboard. And part of that is because of the key bindings. I mean, they have specialized keys on the Mac platform that aren't going to translate necessarily over to just any old USB keyboard. And so those are usually about $98 for a keyboard and a mouse.
Wow. Yeah, I wasn't aware that there were specific key bindings for the Mac that were different from the key bindings on a PC.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
A Mac mouse only has one button, too, right?
Well, no, they now have functionality for multiple buttons. It just looks like it has one button.
All right.
But that's actually one of the key bindings, is the way to get to a right-click without actually having a right-click button enabled. So, yeah, there's lots of weird little funky things going on. And then, of course, you have to get the Mac-branded monitor for that. So that's, like, the cheapest one they sell is $600.
Yeah, heaven forbid you get something that wasn't the right color.
Exactly. So it's, you know, you're looking at a good $1,300 for your basic, you know, essentially what would be a tower, except that you're not getting the expandability function, you know?
Sure.
And especially with the latest operating system, if you are a Mac user already and you're thinking of upgrading to the latest and greatest OS, and you're running older hardware, it's kind of like a Vista thing, you know. It's only worse, I think, because you literally, whereas on the PC you have the option of, all right, going out and buying, you know, spending the $300 on a new graphics card and popping it in your tower. Well, for a Mac Mini or even, you know, obviously the laptops, you don't have that choice. There's no expansion port at all.
Wow, and the Mac Mini isn't an Intel Mac, or it is an Intel Mac?
That has been Intelized, so yeah, they're all Intel now.
They're all Intel Macs, so if somebody wanted to go out and get a Mac Mini and they were so upset that with the Apple software or whatever, they could indeed install Windows and boot to that if they wanted to.
They can. It's a little bit of a, you know, and it's a little bit difficult to do it because you have to repartition the hard drive.
Sure.
And you have to know not something
the novice user who is moving to a Mac because it's easier to use would necessarily know how to do.
Correct.
Yeah.
To be fair, though, most of the time you're going to have to do something with the partition installing Linux, but it usually gets done for you during the install.
Correct. Yeah. And that's the great thing about all the Macs. If you did go out and buy it and you were realizing that you're a little sick and tired of the restrictions that they impose, you can always put Linux on there and it runs really, really well, just as well as on any, you know, especially now that the most of the chipsets are the same as kind of like a what would be called a Centrino system on the PC side, where it's got all the Intel parts. You know, I mean, love it or hate it, Intel's got a lot of open source, or not open source, but they've got a lot of Linux compatible drivers.
Sure.
Okay.
So we're looking, I think, like if you're looking for a new Mac, you're looking at about $1,400, and obviously you get the OS with that. And if you're just upgrading from an old Mac to the new OS, you're looking at $130. So that's, I think, a lot less than Windows, if I recall your guys' prices.
Okay.
Right.
That sounds right.
Now, if someone were wanting a laptop, though, a MacBook, I guess is what they call them.
Yeah, so those
are we talking higher-priced hardware here?
They have, some bargain, sort of bargainish laptops. I think the lowest, absolute lowest configuration you can get is $1,100 for a MacBook.
And that's the lowest price, you know.
What's that? Yeah.
That's the lowest price. As opposed to the $400 or $300 I've seen them on sale, Intel or AMD processor-based PC.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
As a low-end laptop in the Windows or Linux side of things, traditional Linux.
When I was looking to switch to Linux, I went out and bought a Sony Vaio because I just wasn't sure how Linux would run on a Mac, and it was a new world for me, so I wanted to just start with something that was sort of a more common, you know, known factor. And that was a Sony. I mean, it's a great little laptop, and it didn't cost me nearly as much as a Mac would have.
Sure, but Sony's kind of proprietary in their hardware as well. How was installing Linux on that? That, depending on the model, could be a problem.
It was incredibly simple, actually. And
really?
Mind you, I started out with Slackware. So,
okay.
But it was really, it does really well because it's a Centrino. system inside, so it was all Intel, so there were drivers for everything.
Now that's good.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know what I was doing anyway, but that's what I did.
So what's your background with Macintosh?
Oh, I've been using Macintosh for my entire life, actually. And now I do film and video editing on it and a lot of graphic work on it for work. Yeah, I know everything about Macs.
So back to the costs of this, it sounds like the hardware is going to run you between $1,100 on the low end and going up from there, depending on how pricey you want your hardware to be. And what about the software?
Okay, so software, there's a couple
of You get the
different
operating
choices.
System with the hardware, right?
Exactly. You do get the operating system, and if it's a new computer, you get a fair amount of software with it, which we'll talk about in a minute. First thing, I guess, is the Office Suite. I think that's what you guys were talking about first in episode 25, because being able to write documents, aside from in a little text editor kind of notepad-y kind of thing, pretty important. So I think that the cheapest way you're going to get away with that is with the Apple-branded iWork. And that is a little package that includes a word processor, a little spreadsheet, and a presentation package.
Okay.
And it's $80. So, you know, it's pretty good price-wise, I think. Not as good as OpenOffice or KOffice or AbbeyWord, which costs
By the way,
$0.
Cost how much?
It's $0, actually.
$0.
Yeah. Unless you donate, which I actually think I did when I got OpenOffice. I think I sent them some money because I was like, well, I'm not buying anything else, so.
Good idea.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, now you were saying that the iWork is $80. Are you saying that the Mac doesn't come with an Office Suite out of the box?
It comes with trial versions of iWork and Office. And
oh, really?
It's wonderful to see new users start using these programs, not realizing that they're trial versions, and then 30 days later, all their data cannot be accessed because they were trial versions, and they won't let them back into the Office.
Oh,
oh wow.
Yeah, it's fun to see that. That's
oh, and they don't tell you up front that they're trial versions, huh?
Well, you know what? They do, but it's every you know, those dialog boxes, people... I don't know what it is about the user in those dialog boxes. They just don't seem to understand what the dialog boxes are telling them. So
well,
they don't
read them because they want to get on with using the program, and they know that they're conditioned that you know, whenever they install something, there's going to be a user license agreement, and unless you say you accept it, you can't use the program. So why bother reading it? That's kind of the attitude.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And it doesn't really say, by the way, if you do anything in this program, you're not going to be able to access it. I mean, if you think about it logically, then you would figure that out, but it's not really telling you that. You know, it's just like, do you want to buy me? Well, no, I don't want to buy you. I just want to write some letters. You know, it's not going to tell you that you will not be able to open these in any way, you know, afterwards.
It'd be nice if they warned you a week ahead of time.
Right, yeah, so... So $80 is as cheap as you're getting by. Now, the other big Office Suite for Mac is one that you guys are probably vaguely familiar with, Microsoft Office.
I've heard of that.
I've heard of that,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a distant memory for probably all of us. But it clocks in at a little bit cheaper even than again, on the PC side, and I'm not really sure why, but it's $500.
Mm-hmm.
I think you guys had said it was $680 for the Ultimate version.
Right, and that's list price for it, of course. So, and there are different versions of it, which range from that top end price of $680 down to about $150 for a home and student edition, with many price points in between. So, from a realistic perspective, the average user who wants to purchase Microsoft Office for their own personal use is going to buy the $150 version. If it's a business, they're going to buy the $680 version, but of course they're a business, so they end up with business licenses, which if they're a very large business, Microsoft will license it to companies for, let's say, a $600 or $700 software program like Office might cost a large corporation $30 a copy.
Yeah. Yeah,
well,
that's a good.
plus extra cost. Now, I've been in offices that had Microsoft stuff, and they had a person, an internal person, a company person, that would go around to every machine now and then and make sure that everything, all the licenses were paid for, or it had to come off that machine.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So you got to pay that person too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I think that's a really good point, because, I mean, if we played by, you know, if everyone in the world played by the rules, and we know that they don't, because I think there's like an inherent sort of moral or, you know, kind of moral gauge that we all have. And we know that, okay, if I bought Office for $680, I should be able to put it on all three of my machines, even though mm-hmm. it only comes with one license or whatever
right.
it would be.
Yeah.
You know, but.
And I can get it from Steve down by the railroad tracks for $5.
Exactly. But if Microsoft made us do what they wanted us to do, it would be a lot more money.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that's to say nothing of the infamous people in Russia who have been
right,
pirating Microsoft software for so many years that it's harder to find a licensed version than a pirated copy, at least from the news
yeah.
reports that I've heard.
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well.
Yeah.
I imagine China's in that category too.
I would
yeah,
think
yeah.
so. From
Not to single those two out. I'm sure there's a lot of countries.
Well, New
yeah,
York
sure.
City, too.
Oh, yeah.
that country, yeah. Good.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's I'm clocking in at about 1900-ish if you're new to Mac. So if you
mm-hmm.
just decide you're going to abandon Windows and you're just going to jump headfirst into Mac land, you're looking at $1,900 investment for really a low-end system with the software that you would have to get, you know, to play by everyone's rules. 210 if you already have a Mac, or if you inherit a Mac from someone and
mm-hmm.
you just want to kind of update with the lowest possible sort of things to get you up to date.
What about a mail program? Does the Mac
yeah,
provide
it actually
you...
comes with a mail program, which is notoriously unstable and
oh.
really bad with preserving its settings. Everyone, at least I think that, you know, knows anything, jumps to Thunderbird right away.
Really? Okay, so open source is as big a deal on the Mac where it's available as it is on Windows-based computers as well. So Thunderbird is the ultimate cross-platform mail system. So there's a version for Mac as well, huh?
Absolutely, and it's great because people get used to it. They already know the brand. You know, they know Firefox already because Firefox is everywhere on the Mac as well. Even though they have their own browser, they like Thunderbird. And, you know, as many people as I can tell about OpenOffice, or as they call it on the Mac side, NeoOffice.
Uh-huh.
That's the Mac port of OpenOffice. So, you know, there's a lot of good open source alternatives out there that you can kind of turn people onto.
Right, as there are on the PC. And I know that in our episode 25 that you mentioned earlier, we've had since then a couple of listeners write in and say, hey, you've forgotten about the fact that, you know, in your cost analysis that you could put open source software on your Windows machine and bring the cost down substantially. And that's true. And
that
it's true with the Macintosh as well. But
you're not going to bring it down to zero.
That's
no,
right.
You're not going to bring it down to zero.
And the other thing is many people buy into the one vendor if it's Microsoft, or in the case of Apple, if it's Macintosh, then we should stick with that brand. And I think from the advertising I've seen, Apple's very good at branding things and developing brand loyalty within its customers.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you don't want to be the dorky PC guy. You want to be the hip young Mac guy in those commercials.
That's
know?
Right.
But, you know, and also, and Apple actually reinforces this substantially too. If you walk into for support, or if you call them up for support and you say, okay, I can't get my Thunderbird to send out, you know, mail because of some kind of firewall setting that you guys built into Leopard, they're not going to help you. They're going to say, well, Thunderbird's a third-party application. We can't support that.
Mm-hmm.
And they will, you know, they and much less like NeoOffice. You know, if you call someone up and say, hey, something's wrong with NeoOffice, they're not going to support that. They're going to tell you to get onto something that they own and, you know, pay that price. So it's not like they really encourage open source alternatives at all.
Is there a Macintosh community you can go to with that kind of question?
Well, that's kind of a weird weighted question. Actually, the Mac community, and if you've ever listened to the Linux Action Show, you'll hear a lot about this. the Mac community is kind of famously, I mean, a lot of the community that I knew when I was using Mac back in the day, I don't know what happened to them. I think they might have all jumped over to Linux or something, because the Mac community as is are the ones who bought into the branding, you know? And so it's not like they're really a community for the platform. They're just kind of a community, I don't know, they're a community because they all own a Mac, but they're not a community. You know what I mean?
Right.
Okay.
Although, there is a support page on Apple, and you can post there. And depending on what you're posting, you may or may not get help. So yes and no,
well,
I guess.
Well, to be fair, you're not always going to get help with Linux either.
Very true. I meant more that you'll get your question removed from the forum.
Oh.
Yeah. I've posted things that I guess were considered more controversial than what they wanted to deal with. You know, security problems that I had with Mac. And so my questions actually did get removed. One of my removals was actually slash dotted and got a little bit of interesting attention simply because I asked a question about a security problem that I found in one of their services.
And it went away.
It went away. So, yeah, you won't find that anywhere on the web now. It's gone. It's been erased. So.
Huh. I haven't seen that very much in the Linux forums that I've been involved with.
No,
it seems like criticism, security concerns, you know, that seems pretty much in the open. In fact, some distributions have that as part of their social contract, as Debian calls it, you know, that everything, there's not going to be anything concealed. Everything's out in the open.
To be complete about it, I think that's part of the open source development attitude, is that you don't hide the flaws, you uncover the flaws so they can be fixed.
Exactly, yeah, which makes sense to me, and that's why I kind of thought, you know, that I should post the issue that I was having on the Apple forum so that everyone
sure
could read about it and fix it, but it doesn't work like that in this world.
That's got to be very frustrating.
Oh yeah, that's pretty frustrating. Wow, what a great interview this is so far, no? Well, it's time to take a coffee break. So go get yourself a cup of coffee and come right back and we'll pick up the interview where we've left off. You know, what you don't get, guys, is a really powerful graphic editor. You do get what they call iPhoto, which is kind of like an F-Spot photo manager.
Right.
I've had it. It comes free with some Windows, like if you buy a scanner.
Yeah, exactly, like those things. And it has some, like, it has some adjustment tools, but nothing like, you know, what you're really going to need. So you're going to have to get Photoshop or something.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, I thought
it's for touching up your photos.
Exactly.
Well, I thought part of the marketing focus with the Mac is that it's for the graphics designer. It's for the creative types. It's less for the business and more for the people that would use that. And it doesn't come with that kind of software?
Yeah, no. It turns out, Larry, that marketing, apparently they don't always tell the truth.
Who knew?
I know, who knew? Turns out, you know, you might be a cool, hip artist and everything, but you're still going to have to pay, in theory, for, you know, the software that's going to enable you to do your digital art. And in the graphics world, you know, I mean, literally, if you look over at most people's Macintosh, because Macs are known as graphic machines, it's really easy to find a pirated copy of Photoshop. You know, you just look on LimeWire or whatever, and you download Photoshop, and it's pretty simple. So most people have the full version of Photoshop, sometimes the full CS suite. So, I mean, if I wanted to be literal about what, like, looking at people's machines and say, you know, if you had done that legally, you would be paying this. You know, sometimes you're looking at $2,000 of software because that's what the CS3 suite from Adobe costs.
Sure.
Wow. And even just Photoshop alone is like $600 or $700.
And getting caught with a pirated copy is not inexpensive either.
Correct. And I used to be certified in Photoshop. I used to be a certified Photoshop person. And I let that go away. But I mean, there's nothing that I used to do in Photoshop that I am not able now to do in the GIMP. The GIMP is a great program.
Mm-hmm.
It's very powerful.
It is.
And yeah, I mean, it suits all my needs. So yeah, you're looking at very expensive alternatives. I think the cheapest you could get away with is like Photoshop Elements, which has some of the really basic functionality of Photoshop, right. And that's like $90 for the Mac.
Wow.
Lots of people, again, the Mac marketing machine kind of says that they can do websites on their new machine.
Sure.
And again, while it's true that you can, and they do have a nice little GUI kind of drag and drop web designing program on there,
mm-hmm.
people outgrow it very, very fast. You can't do more than one site. You can't really update it too often. And the code that it produces, as you can imagine, is just really, really bad.
What do you mean you can't update it too often? Do they have a timer built in? I mean, what's going on? What's behind that comment?
Well, yeah, I know. It seems odd, but it's true. It seems that if you start throwing, you know, maybe you've got a blog or something, right? So you're doing like daily posts. Well, for whatever reason, for the past two versions, updating it frequently breaks your website. Just something in the CSS gets screwed up, the files become corrupt, and there's not really a way around it except to redo it.
Well, I have another question about that, and Tom and I are learning an awful lot about Macs on this show. But
yeah.
Now, my brother has a Mac, and he sends me links to photos that he has on something called .Mac, is what he calls it.
Yes.
What is that, and how does that relate to photos? I mean, it sounded to me like that's kind of a little website designing area where he can do the drag and drop thing, and it's really easy to create a website. And so what is .Mac, and how does that relate?
Okay, so .Mac is the thing that they're going to try to sell you, and even if you don't buy it in the store or from the website, you're going to learn very quickly that to do everything that they're advertising that you can do, you needed .Mac, which is their yearly subscription service. It's $100 for the year, which isn't bad. You know, you get some server space, you get an email address, but more importantly, it enables you to, for instance, publish that website stuff that you're dragging and dropping and creating. It enables you to send photos from your iPhoto to like a little web gallery, kind of their competitor for Flickr, things like that.
Yeah, that's what my brother sends
me. Okay.
Yeah, and that's, you know, basically their marketing is just kind of not telling you that you also need to buy .Mac in order for all of this stuff to work. So that's an extra $100 that no one's talking about.
So if you have your own website, or let's say you're doing a podcast and you've got a Libsyn account or something like that, does the web authoring tool that comes with the Mac that you're talking about here, and I'm making an assumption there that it comes with the Mac, that you don't have to pay for it on top of all that, but let's assume for a second that you have that, whether you've paid for it or not. Would that allow you to create a web page and put it on any site, or it'll only work with the .Mac?
Well, now, if they let you do it to any site, you wouldn't have any reason to buy the .Mac, would you?
Right.
So
the answer is no. Okay.
Yeah. There is a way. There's a hack that you can do that gets it out of iWeb into a folder that you could feasibly upload to your FTP. But now you really are uploading if you change one letter on your site, you're just re-uploading your entire site. So if it's a site with a lot of stuff on it, you know, you're looking at, you know, just probably, I mean, so much information transfer a month, it would just be ridiculous.
Wow. And not just the one page, the entire site.
Yeah, exactly.
Holy mackerel.
I mean, in theory, it should be possible to do one page. You should go in there and find the HTML page and upload it. But I'm telling you, the code that it produces, I don't think you guys, if you looked at, you know HTML, right?
Sure.
A little bit, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you looked at this stuff, it would boggle your mind. I mean, it's just unbelievably bad.
Yeah, well, I use Composer for the Going Linux site, and I used to use EnView before that, and whenever I change the contents of a page, I just upload, or as they put it in those software applications, publish that page, and that's all that gets updated. And in fact, if I don't change any of the graphics, all that's updated is the HTML. You know, none of the graphics get changed even. So,
right.
And I have used the Microsoft web design software, and Even that, although its code tends to be non-standard and incompatible, or at least it used to be. I understand that they've made some improvements in that. But at least...
I don't know. I think they keep that a moving target, Larry.
Maybe so. They say they've made some improvements in that. But in the past, even though it's been very difficult to understand from an HTML perspective, it's a little non-standard. At least if you changed one page, you didn't have to upload your entire site. It sounds like Apple is definitely locking you in with proprietary stuff here.
Oh, yeah. Apple's really getting really good at I guess, yeah, that kind of lock-in mentality. They're getting frightfully good at that. Most of their file formats are very, very proprietary, actually. I can talk to you about that sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so website stuff is going to cost you one way or another. I guess another way would be just to get a third-party application if you're going to do serious web stuff.
Sure.
Again, a lot of people look at Adobe Dreamweaver, which, you know, I'm sure that's, I mean, obviously hundreds of dollars. There are other companies out there. There's one called Freeway, which I was able to find for like $100 online for this example.
That's not
so I haven't actually
bad,
used
yeah.
it. I gather it's a step above iWeb and a step below Dreamweaver.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Okay, so that's kind of the low end other than open source stuff.
And you mentioned podcasting, actually. And I remember in your guys' episode, you were talking about Avid Express Pro, which is a $1,500 application.
Right, uh-huh.
That's a lot of money for audio editing. Realistically, and I don't know how to... I mean, the Mac has a lot of audio editing software available for it, as I'm sure PC does as well. You know, anything by Avid is going to be in that price range, like, you know, $1,500. Apple has a couple of different packages of their own that range from about, really anywhere from like $80 to $200 to about $500, I think. And, you know, at the low end, they're really crashy and buggy. And then at the high end, they're pretty stable. So it just depends, I guess, on what your level of expertise is.
Sure, and there are definitely less expensive software for audio editing on the PC as well, under Windows. And my point in picking Avid Express Pro for our analysis was this was for the high-end system, so I was assuming somebody wanted high-end software to begin with. And as someone who has only ever used Audacity either on the PC or on Linux to do audio editing, I just went into Google and put audio editing software into the search and went to look for the first four or five sites that came up with Windows software, and that was one of the ones that repeated. So I assumed, maybe correctly, maybe incorrectly, that because it was high in the ranks and because it was repeated, it was something that was relatively popular. So maybe I was right, maybe I was wrong. There are definitely less expensive packages for Windows as well. But I don't think anything beats open source, free as in beer.
No.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, in all the applications that we're talking about, obviously there's a whole spectrum of stuff.
Absolutely.
But,
I take it Audacity is not going to go onto a Mac?
It will run on a Mac, yeah. That's how I... That was probably my first open source application that I ever used.
Okay.
I just thought it was a really cool program, and I didn't know why it was free, but I sure loved using it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Audacity, yeah, they build it for lots of stuff. It's a great one. Actually, we're talking about audio, and a lot of people, if they're going to switch to Mac, they're going to bring with them a whole bunch of, well, audio files, you know, that they have collected through the years, MP3s, maybe Windows Media, audio files, things like that.
Uh-huh.
The Mac, even though it is kind of touted as a multimedia kind of platform, it has the same issue with my favorite subject, codecs, as, you know, everything else does. And if you bring your Windows Media files and certain kinds of MPEG or AVI files over to the Mac, you're going to find pretty quickly that your media doesn't play.
Hmm.
Oh.
Now, why am I surprised that Windows Media doesn't play on a Mac?
Okay, admittedly, that's not so strange.
Yeah.
There are, of course, plugins and things like that that you can acquire to enable playback of certain things. But at a certain point, you're going to find that you're going to just have to buy the pro version of their multimedia engine, which is QuickTime. So QuickTime Pro it's $30. It's not a big deal.
Right.
But it's just one of those things where a new user coming to the Mac with all the marketing and all the hype, they open it up, they just expect, you know, they're going to plug in their hard drive that they had everything transferred to from their PC. They just don't understand why suddenly none of their music files will play.
Well, to be honest, that's the same sort of attitude that people have, new users to Linux have, is they move stuff over and they expect it to work. And with proprietary drivers and proprietary applications that you need codecs as well to play these things, and Linux distributions attempting to stay as pure to GNU as they can, it's often something that is difficult for a new Linux user to figure out as well.
Doesn't Linux Mint just say to heck with it and include everything?
You can find distributions that do that, and I think those are the ones that are looking at Linux from a practical perspective.
Sure.
But the ones that get the big press, Ubuntu included, you know, Ubuntu, Red Hat, SUSE, all of those typically don't have those things installed by default. Now, they make it easy to get them, you still have to go and get them. And it would be nice if everything, you know, from a practical perspective, it would be nice if everything were installed by default and if we could all just get along. But
But Larry, you were at my talk at scale, so you know the reasoning behind all of
Indeed.
That stuff, and that's got little to do with the less to do, I guess, with the computer, I guess the OS, and more with the vendors of the codecs themselves.
Sure,
so,
the electronics of it all is very capable of doing anything that we want it to do. It's the legality
exactly.
of it.
Yeah.
If we'd all just agree to go to OGG.
Yeah,
I wish.
It'd all be over.
That's the day I'm waiting for. And that's interesting, too, because Apple actually does not support OGG natively. You know, I mean, certainly you can get OGG codecs for the Mac via like VLC and things like that, but there's no, you know, it's a free codec, of course, and people just can't understand why a computer manufacturer wouldn't just say, okay, well, it doesn't cost us anything, let's just throw it into the mix.
Sure.
And they don't.
Well,
and in fact, they've even developed their own codecs to lock you into their platform.
I was just going to say that if they were to support OGG, that wouldn't support the DRM initiative at all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's a dangerous thing for them to do from a business standpoint, I guess.
Speaking of this, and I think I told you, Larry, I bought a brand new SanDisk, SANSA, 2 GB, a wonderful little MP3 player, FM radio, voice recorder, excellent quality. And I popped in the disk so that I could read the owner's manual. And way at the bottom of the owner's manual, there's the boilerplate that you agree to by opening the package. Even though you haven't seen it yet.
Right.
And one of the things is, SanDisk is a Microsoft trusted vendor as far as all DRM and protecting Hollywood and all that stuff is concerned. But if it ever turns out that Microsoft decides that SanDisk isn't, then Microsoft can disable my player.
Oh, wow.
And by opening the package, I agreed to that.
You agreed to it.
Which means now I have to find a Microsoft machine to plug my player into once in a while in case they want to disable it.
Yeah, you just go do that, Tom.
I will.
Sure.
Well, I think Rockbox does support the SANSA players. So if you ever want to hack away at it, just go to rockbox.org.
Really?
I'm pretty sure. I interviewed one of the guys from Rockbox, and he was talking a little bit about SANSA, so I'm pretty sure they support it. That's what I've got on my iPods.
Mm-hmm.
Love it.
Excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm on the way as soon as we hang up.
Right. Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah, I guess that's about it. I mean, so I think you're looking, if you inherit a Mac or if you've got a Mac and you're just keeping up with the advancements, as they call them, you're looking at about $610. If you are jumping ship from something or another, deciding to go over to Mac, the lowest end hardware that you can find and kind of moderate software, you're looking at about $2,400.
And if you compare that to our analysis of doing the same thing with Windows, the upgrade was a little over $400. So we're talking about the same ballpark in that $500 range.
Yep.
And with that very expensive audio editing software, our full boat buying it came out to just under $3,000 if you get a less expensive audio editor. Of course, we're in the same ballpark, but you don't get the hardware. That's just the software. So the Apple gives you the hardware for free, is what you're saying.
Well, I'm really being kind for the hardware. I'm telling you, you're not going to be able to walk away with what I'm saying that you're buying here. Just the low end of Mac is just, I mean, they cheat you in the most horrible places, you know, things that you just can't, you know, you're just not going to be able to settle for it. You're going to have to go to the next level up. Maybe just one level.
That, and I also heard you say per year after at least one of those prices you were talking about, the .Mac account was $100 a year.
Yeah.
And so there's some recurring cost there if you want to continue to have your software able to be used.
Yeah, and if you are looking for a community, like Tom was saying, I mean, there is a culture behind all of this marketing that is developing, and they're going to try to sell it to you because community isn't free like it is in Linux. And you need to buy like the .Mac, you need to buy their little training package and their support package and all these different packages that they're going to try to throw at you. And in a way that makes you feel like you're becoming part of the Mac group, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm being pretty kind with what you're walking out of the store.
Extra care, that's a recurring cost?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Well, there are different levels. I mean, it's a whole maze of different sort of... I think of it like Scientology. You know, you can reach like a certain level, but then you have to pay more, and then you get to a certain level, and you get to pay more. And by the end, you're like this great Mac user, you know?
Broke Mac user.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now there's a guy in a van with binoculars in front of my house. What's going on here?
Oh, right, yeah.
Let's not talk about Scientology.
I forgot to tell you guys about that.
And I've noticed a black helicopter hovering over mine, so...
Yeah. Well, I broadcast from outer space, so I don't have any of those problems. So the latest upgrade that I did on my iBook was to Fedora 8, and that set me back $0.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd have used the Going Linux code there, you could have gotten 50% off.
You know, about the only thing other than hardware that I have spent money on lately for my computer might be, you know, software-wise, about the only thing I think a Linux user might pay for would be if they wanted to do the right thing and purchase the codecs for playing the MPEG files and the MP3 files and all of that. They would go and purchase the Fluendo plugin set, which you're paying in euros, but it works out to between $41 and $42 US. And that would be about the only real software cost that anyone would have to pay.
That's really not terrible.
With Linux.
Yeah, and it amazes me too. I mean, a lot of the marketing again is saying that, you know, you can just be so much more productive on, you know, this platform or that platform. And you know, I mean, I like to think that I'm just about as productive as I am now running Linux as I ever was on a Mac. And frankly, I have fewer headaches on Linux simply because there's not the restrictions that I used to encounter on the Mac.
You can measure productivity a number of different ways, but one of the ways I measure productivity is if I need a tool, software tool, to use, if I own Windows or if I own a Mac, it sounds like, and I need a new tool, I have to go and order it and pay for it and wait for it to be delivered, or I have to go to the store and pick it up. With Linux, you just open your package manager, type in a search just as you would under Google, and install it.
Yeah, and if you don't like it?
That's productivity in my mind.
Yeah, if you don't like it, you're out nothing. Yeah. Uninstall it and try another one.
Right, no.
Right.
Yeah, it's a great thing. Yeah, well, guys, thanks for being on my show. It was great to have you guys on the Bad Apples at last. I've been listening to your show for ages now, and I've really, really enjoyed it, so I'm really happy to have gotten you guys on my show. For this episode, I have sort of a little contest, I guess, to announce. I was given and sent a pretty good little care package from Fedora, and it includes a t-shirt, a Fedora t-shirt, which I only have in the size large. That is what they sent. I also have official Fedora, one live CD, and one installed DVD. So that is kind of cool. It's, you know, the official artwork and everything like that. So that's kind of neat. And in addition to that, I have a Linux Identity magazine on entirely on Fedora. It's a great walkthrough on what Fedora is and how to install it and how to use it and how to customize it and things like that. No, it's specifically on Fedora 8. All of this is Fedora 8. And I know Fedora 9 Alpha is out as of a couple of weeks ago. So it's not exactly cutting edge at this point, but it is definitely obviously a really, really solid release. Very, very great release. And this could make either a really good package for yourself if you're just looking to get a good copy of Fedora with some Fedora paraphernalia, or it could be a great little gift to someone you're trying to get into Linux or who has been asking about Linux. You know, give them a copy of the CD or give them the DVD. This magazine, Linux Identity Magazine, has two DVDs in the back of it, a 32-bit install DVD and the 64-bit install DVD. So that's a total of something like four discs, right? And then, like I say, a large t-shirt. So if you want that care package, I will gladly send it to you. But you have to email me at gort.klaatu@gmail.com. And in this email, you must describe to me what the world is going to look like after the big apocalyptic happening that is, I guess, going to happen in the year, I don't know, 2029. And what that looks like, because obviously the Windows users aren't going to survive and the Mac users aren't going to survive, so it's just going to be a whole bunch of Linux users that survived all of this. What the world is going to look like, how we've organized ourselves, and how we proceed to make the world a livable place again. If that's too sci-fi for you, I guess you can cop out and just tell me why you don't like Macs, as long as that reason isn't because they're too hip or too expensive or too cliche or something, because that's an old one. I've heard that before. But I would prefer your description of the world after the great apocalypse and only Linux users are surviving. That would be really swell. And if I like your entry, I'll probably end up reading it on the air, and I'll send you this Fedora package. And if you don't like Fedora, you should try it now, because if you haven't tried it lately, it's really pretty cool. And if you think you're just a Debian person, you know, you should try Fedora anyway, because it's fun, and it's Linux, and it's really cool. Tom and Larry both had a lot of great things to say, I think. They have a great show. If you haven't heard it, it's goinglinux.com. I have a feeling that it's going to be kind of the next Linux reality. I mean, it's a really good episode, or it's a good show to tell new Linux users about, because the more I recommend Linux to people, the more I realize that giving them something they will kind of latch onto and listen to is really nice. And it's not as I find their show, you know, less technical than Linux Reality was. So Linux Reality was really great, but it was still a little bit on the hacker side of things, I think. Going Linux is really more of the, I guess, productivity sensibility. It really talks about, you know, the applications that people are going to need to kind of become familiar with if they're going to switch to Linux realistically. And I think a lot of us forget it once we're really into Linux, or if we're those kinds of people who got into Linux for the technical side of things because we're interested in computers and things like that. There's a whole other segment of the population out there who actually are getting into Linux and have no desire to know anything about the technical side of things. They just want to know, okay, I'm going to switch. Make it easy on me. Visit the website, thebadapples.info, for show notes, for free wallpaper, things like that. You can also email me at gort.klaatu@gmail.com.